Chapter 81. Of the ordering of men among themselves and to other things. In comparison with other intellectual substances, the human soul holds the lowest place because, as we have already stated, when it is first created it receives knowledge of the order of divine providence only in a general way, whereas, in order to acquire perfect knowledge of that order in individual matters, it needs to start from these very things in which the order of divine providence is already established in detail. Consequently, the human soul needs bodily organs, so as to be able to receive knowledge from things having bodies. And yet, on account of the weakness of its intellectual light, it is unable to acquire perfect knowledge of things that concern man, without the help of higher spirits, God so disposing that the lower spirits reach perfection through the higher, as we have already proved. Since, however, man has some share of intellectual light, dumb animals which have none at all are subject to man, according to the order of divine providence. Hence it is said, Genesis 1:26, let us make man to our own image and likeness, that is to say, inasmuch as he is an intelligent being, and let him have dominion over the fishes of the sea, and the fowls of the air, and the beasts of the earth. Dumb animals, though bereft of intellect, yet, since they have some kind of knowledge, are placed by the order of divine providence above plants and other things devoid of knowledge. Hence it is said, Genesis 1:29-30, behold, I have given you every herb bearing seed upon the earth, and all trees that have in themselves seed of their own kind, to be your meat, and to all the beasts of the earth. Among those that are wholly bereft of knowledge, one thing is placed before another according as one is more capable of action than another. For they have no share in the disposition of providence, but only in the execution. And since man has both intelligence, and sense, and bodily powers, these things are dependent on one another, according to the disposition of divine providence, in likeness to the order to be observed in the universe. For bodily power is subject to the powers of sense and intellect, as carrying out their commands, and the sensitive power is subject to the intellective, and is controlled by its rule. In the same way, we find order among men. For those who excel in intelligence are naturally rulers, whereas those who are less intelligent, but strong in body, seem made by nature for service, as Aristotle says in his Politics. The statement of Solomon is in agreement with this: the fool shall serve the wise, as also the words of Exodus provide, out of all the people wise, 35, men such as fear God, who may judge the people at all times. And just as in the works of one man there is disorder through the intellect being obsequious to the sensual faculty, while the sensual faculty, through indisposition of the body, is drawn to the movement of the body, as instanced in those who limp, so too, in human government disorder results from a man being set in authority, not on account of his excelling in intelligence, but because he has usurped the government by bodily force, or has been appointed to rule through motives of sensual affection. Nor does Solomon omit to mention this disorder, for he says, there is an evil that I have seen under the sun, as it were by an error proceeding from the face of the prince, a fool set in high dignity. Now divine providence does not exclude a disorder of this kind, for it results, by God's permission, from the fault of the inferior agents, even as we have said of other evils. Nor is the natural order wholly perverted by such a disorder, for the government of fools is weak, unless it be strengthened by the counsels of the wise. Hence it is said, designs are strengthened by counsels, and wars are to be arranged by governments, and a wise man is strong, and a knowing man, stout and valiant, because war is managed by due ordering, and there shall be safety when there are many counsels. And since the counselor rules him who receives his counsel, and, in a sense, governs him, it is said that a wise servant shall rule over foolish sons. It is therefore evident that divine providence imposes order on all things, and thus the apostle says truly that the things which are of God are well ordered. Chapter 82. That the inferior bodies are ruled by God by means of the heavenly bodies. Just as in intellectual substances some are of higher and some of lower degree, sota are the incorporeal substances. Now intellectual substances are governed by higher substances, so that the disposition of divine providence may reach down proportionately to the lowest things, as we have already said. Therefore in like manner bodies of lower degree are ruled by those of a higher. Again, the higher a body is as regards its place, the more formal it is, hence it is reasonably the place of a lower body, because form contains even as place does. Thus water is more formal than earth, air than water, fire than air. Now the heavenly bodies have a higher place than all others. Therefore they are more formal and consequently more active than all other bodies. Therefore they act on lower bodies and consequently the latter are ruled by them. Besides, that which in its nature is perfect without contrariety, is of more universal power than that which in its nature is not perfected without contrariety, because contrariety arises from differences which determine and contract the genus. Wherefore in the conception of the intellect, forasmuch as it is universal, the species of contraries are not contrary to one another, since they coexist in the intellect. Now the heavenly bodies are perfect in their respective natures without any contrariety, for they are neither light nor heavy, neither hot nor cold, whereas the inferior bodies are not perfect in their respective natures without any contrariety. This is proved by their movements, for there is no contrary to the circular movement of the heavenly bodies, so that there can be nothing violent in them, whereas there are movements contrary to that of the lower bodies. For instance, downward movement is contrary to upward movement. Therefore heavenly bodies have a more universal power than the inferior bodies. Now universal powers move particular powers, as we have proved. The heavenly bodies move and govern lower bodies. Moreover, we have shown that all other things are ruled by intellectual substances. Now the heavenly bodies resemble the intellectual substances more than other bodies do, forasmuch as they are incorruptible. Moreover they are nearer to them, inasmuch as they are moved by them immediately, as we have shown above. Therefore the lower bodies are ruled by them. Further, the first principle of movement must be something immovable. Consequently things that approach nearest to immobility must be the movers of others. Now heavenly bodies approach nearer to the immobility of a first principle than do the inferior bodies, because they have but one species of movement, namely local, whereas other bodies have all manner of movements. Therefore the heavenly bodies move and rule the lower bodies. Again, in each genus the first is the cause of that which comes after. Now the heavenly movement is the first of all movements. First, because local movement precedes all others, both in point of time, because it alone can be everlasting, as is proved in innate physics, 7. And naturally because without it there could be no other, since a thing cannot be increased without a previous alteration, whereby that which was dissimilar is transformed and assimilated, nor can there be alteration without a previous change of place, since in order that there be alteration, the cause of alteration must become nearer to the subject altered than it was before. And in perfection, because local movement does not cause a thing to vary in respect of something inherent, but only in respect of something extrinsic, and for this reason belongs to a thing already perfect. Secondly, because even among local movements, circular movement holds the first place, both in point of time, because it alone can be everlasting, as proved in innate physics, 8. And naturally because it excels in simplicity and unity, since it is not divided into beginning, middle and end, but is all middle, as it were. And in perfection, because it returns to its principle. Thirdly, because alone the heavenly movement is always regular and uniform, since in the movements of heavy and light bodies the speed increases towards the end if the movement be natural, and decreases if the movement be violent. Therefore the movement of the heaven must be the cause of all other movements. Further, as that which is simply immovable is in comparison with movement simply, so is that which is immovable in respect of a particular kind of movement, in comparison with that particular movement. Now that which is simply immovable is the principle of all movement, as we have proved. Therefore that which is immovable in respect of alteration, is the principle of alteration. Now of all things corporeal the heavenly bodies alone are inalterable. This is proved by their disposition, which is always the same. Therefore the heavenly body is the cause of alteration in all things alterable. But in this lower world alteration is the principle of all movement, because alteration leads to increase and generation, and the generator is a per se mover in the local movement of heavy and light bodies. Consequently the heaven must be the cause of all movement in these lower bodies. Therefore it is evident that the lower bodies are governed by God by means of the heavenly bodies. Chapter 83. Conclusion of the foregoing. From all that has been proved hitherto, we are able to conclude that as regards the design of the order to be imposed on things, God governs all things by Himself. Wherefore Gregory, commenting on Job 34:13, "What other hath He appointed over the earth?" says, "He who created the world by Himself governs it by Himself." And Boethius says, "God rules all things by Himself alone." As to the execution, however, He governs the lower by means of the higher things, bodily things by means of spiritual things. Wherefore Gregory says, "In this visible world nothing can be ruled except by means of the invisible creature, the lower spirits by the higher." Wherefore Dionysius says, that the intelligent heavenly substances first of all shed forth the divine enlightenment on themselves, and bestow on us those manifestations which surpass our capacity, and the lower bodies by the higher. Wherefore Dionysius says, that the sun contributes to the generation of visible bodies, as also to life itself, by means of nourishment, growth and perfection, by cleansing and renewing them. Of all these together Augustine says, as the grosser and lower bodies are ruled in a certain orderly way by bodies of greater subtlety and power, so all bodies are ruled by the rational spirit of life, and the sinful rational spirit by the righteous rational spirit. Chapter 84. That the heavenly bodies do not impress on our intellect. From what has been said it is at once clear that the heavenly bodies cannot be the causes of things concerning our intellect, for it has already been shown that the order of divine providence requires the lower things to be ruled and moved by the higher. Now the intellect, in the natural order, surpasses all bodies, as we have proved already. Consequently heavenly bodies cannot act directly on the intellect. Therefore they cannot be the direct cause of things concerning the intellect. Again, no body acts except through movement, as is proved in innate physics. 6. Now things that are immovable are not caused by movement, because nothing is the result of the movement of an agent except through the agent moving the patient, while the latter is moved. Consequently things that are wholly outside movement cannot be caused by the heavenly bodies. But things concerning the intellect are wholly outside movement, properly speaking, as the philosopher states, 7 Physics, 3. In fact the soul becomes prudent and wise through being free from movement, as he says in the same place. It is not possible, therefore, that the heavenly bodies be the direct cause of things concerning the intellect. Besides, if nothing be caused by a body except in so far as the latter causes movement through the being moved, it follows that whatever receives an impression from a body must be moved. Now nothing is moved except a body, as is proved in 6 Physics, 4. Therefore whatever receives an impression from a body must be either a body or a power of a body. But it was proved in the second book that the intellect is neither a body nor a power of the body. Therefore the heavenly bodies cannot directly make an impression on the intellect. Further, whatever is moved by a thing is reduced thereby from potentiality to act. Now nothing is reduced from potentiality to act except by something in act. Therefore every agent and mover must be, in some way, in act with regard to those things to which the subject, passive or moved, is in potentiality. But the heavenly bodies are not actually intelligible, because they are singular sensibles. Since then our intellect is not in potentiality except to what is actually intelligible, it is impossible for the heavenly bodies to act directly on the intellect. Moreover, a thing's proper operation follows its nature, which generated things acquire by generation, together with their proper operation, as may be seen in heavy and light things, which have their proper movement as soon as they are generated, unless there be an obstacle, and for this reason the generator is said to be a mover. That which, as regards the principle of its nature, is not subject to the action of the heavenly bodies, cannot be subject to them in respect of its operation. Now the intellective faculty is not caused by any bodily principles, but is entirely from an extrinsic source, as we proved above. Therefore the operation of the intellect is not directly subject to the heavenly bodies. Again, things caused by the heavenly movements are subject to time, which is the measure of the first heavenly movement. Therefore those that wholly abstract from time, are not subject to heavenly movements. Now the intellect in its operation abstracts from time, as also from place, for it considers the universal which abstracts from here and now. Therefore the operation of the intellect is not subject to heavenly bodies. Further, nothing acts outside its species. Now the act of the intellect transcends the species and form of any corporeal agent, since every corporeal form is material and individualized, whereas the act of the intellect is universal and immaterial. Consequently no body can understand by means of its corporeal form. Much less, therefore, can any body whatsoever cause the act of intelligence in another. Besides, a thing is not subject to that which is beneath it in respect of that by which it is united to things above it. Now our soul, inasmuch as it is intelligent, is united to intellectual substances, which in the order of nature are above heavenly bodies, because our soul cannot understand except in so far as it derives its intellectual light from those substances. Therefore the intellectual operation cannot be directly subject to the heavenly movements. Moreover, we shall find a confirmation of this if we consider what philosophers have said in the matter. The natural philosophers of old, as Democritus, Empedocles and others, held that intellect differs not from sense, as stated in 4 Metaphysics, 3, and 3 De Anima 3. Hence it follows that, as sense is a corporeal power resulting from a corporeal transmutation, so is the intellect likewise. Wherefore they said, as transmutation of the lower bodies follows transmutation of the higher bodies, that intellectual operation follows the movements of the heavenly bodies according to the words of Homer: "The mind of gods and men on earth is even as their day, which comes from the father of men and gods, the sun, to wit, or rather Jove, whom they called the supreme god, by whom they understood the whole heaven," as Augustine says. Hence too, followed the opinion of the Stoics, who said that the knowledge of the intellect is caused by images of bodies being imprinted on the mind, just as a mirror, or as a page receives the imprinted characters without any action on its part, as Boethius relates. According to this opinion it followed that our intellectual knowledge was chiefly the result of impressions received from heavenly bodies, and consequently it was chiefly the Stoics who held that man's life was bound by a kind of fatal necessity. This opinion, however, is shown to be false, as Boethius says a bit, by the fact that the intellect is capable of synthesis and analysis, and compares the highest with the lowest, and is cognitive of universals and simple forms, none of which is within the capacity of bodies. Consequently it is evident that the intellect does not merely receive the images of bodies, but is possessed of a power that transcends bodies, for the external senses, which receive only images of bodies, do not extend to the things mentioned above. All subsequent philosophers, however, discerned intellect from sense, and assigned, not bodies but immaterial things, as the cause of our knowledge. Thus Plato ascribed this to ideas, and Aristotle to the active intellect. From all this we may gather that to say that the heavenly bodies are the cause of our knowledge, is a sequel to the opinion of those who held that intellect differs not from sense, as Aristotle observes De Anima, Locke, cit. Now it is evident that this opinion is false. Wherefore also manifestly false is the opinion of those who maintain that the heavenly bodies are the direct cause of our knowledge. For this reason Holy Writ assigns as the cause of our knowledge, not a body, but God. Where is God who made me, who hath given songs in the night, who teacheth us more than the beasts of the earth, and instructeth us more than the fowls of the air, and he that teacheth man knowledge? Nevertheless we must observe that although heavenly bodies cannot be the direct cause of our knowledge, They can company operate indirectly towards it. For though the intellect is not a force of the body, yet in us the operation of the intellect cannot be exercised without the operation of bodily forces, namely the imagination, and the powers of memory and thought, as we have already shown. Hence it is that when the activity of these powers is hampered by some bodily indisposition, the activity of the intellect is hampered also, as may be seen in cases of frenzy, lethargy and the like. For the same reason goodness of disposition in a man's body fits him to understand easily, inasmuch as those forces are strengthened by such a disposition, wherefore it is said in 2 De Anima 9, that it is to be observed that men of soft flesh are of quick intelligence. Now the disposition of the human body is subject to the heavenly movements, for Augustine says that it is not altogether absurd to ascribe the mere differences between bodies to the influence of the stars, and Damascene says that the various planets produce in us various temperaments, habits and dispositions. Consequently the heavenly bodies company operate indirectly to the goodness of our intelligence, and thus, even as physicians are able to judge of a man's intelligence from his bodily temperament, as approximate disposition thereto, so too can an astrologer, from the heavenly movements, as being a remote cause of this disposition. In this sense we can approve of the saying of Ptolemy, when Mercury is in one of Saturn's houses at the time of a man's birth, he bestows on him a quick intelligence of the inner nature of things. Chapter 85. That the heavenly bodies are not the cause of our willing and choosing. It is also evident from the foregoing that the heavenly bodies are not the cause of our willing and choosing. For the will is in the intellective part of the soul, according to the philosopher. Therefore if the heavenly bodies cannot make a direct impression on our intellect, as we have proved, will they be able to influence the will directly? Moreover, every act of choice or will in us is caused immediately through an intellectual apprehension, for the apprehended good is the object of the will, wherefore there cannot ensue perverseness of choice, unless the judgment of the intellect err in the particular object of choice, as the philosopher states. But the heavenly bodies are not the cause of our intellectual apprehension. Therefore neither can they be the cause of our choice. Further, whatever takes place in this lower world through the influence of heavenly bodies happens naturally, since the things here below are naturally subordinate to them. If, therefore, the heavenly bodies have any influence on our choice, this must happen naturally, so that, in fact, man naturally chooses to perform his actions, even as dumb animals perform theirs from natural instinct, and as inanimate bodies are moved naturally. Consequently there will not be two active principles, namely purpose and nature, but only one, namely nature. But Aristotle proves the contrary. Therefore it is untrue that the influence of heavenly bodies is the cause of our choice. Besides, things that happen naturally are brought to their end by definite means, wherefore they always happen in the same way, for nature is determined to one method. But man's choice tends to the end in various ways, both in morals and in things made by art. Therefore man's choosing does not come from nature. Again, things which are done naturally, for the most part are done rightly, since nature fails but seldom. Consequently if man chose by nature, his choice would be right for the most part, which is clearly false. Therefore man does not choose naturally, yet this would be the case if his choice were subject to the influence of heavenly bodies. Further, things of the same species do not differ in those natural operations which result from the specific nature. Hence each swallow makes its nest in the same way, and every man equally understands the first principles which are known naturally. Now choosing is an operation that results from the human species. Consequently if man chose naturally, all men would choose in the same way, and this is evidently untrue, both in morals and in things made by art. Moreover, virtue and vice are proper principles of choice, because the virtuous and the vicious man differ through choosing contraries. Now civic virtues and vices are not in us by nature but by habituation. The philosopher proves this from the fact that we acquire the habit of those operations to which we are accustomed, especially from childhood. In us therefore choosing does not come from nature, and consequently, it is not caused by the influence of heavenly bodies, in respect of which things happen naturally. Again, heavenly bodies make no direct impression except on bodies, as we have shown. Consequently, if they are the cause of our choosing, this will be by an impression made either on our bodies, or on external bodies. Yet in neither way can they be a sufficient cause of our choosing. For the objective presentation of some corporeal thing cannot be an adequate cause of our choice, since it is clear that when a man meets with something that pleases him, be it meat or woman, the temperate man is not moved to choose these things, whereas the intemperate is. Again, no possible change wrought in our bodies by an impression of the heavenly bodies can suffice to cause us to make a choice, since all that results therefrom are certain passions, more or less impetuous, and passions, however turbulent, are not a sufficient cause of choosing, since the same passions lead the incontinent to follow them by choice, and fail to induce the continent man. Therefore it must not be said that the heavenly bodies cause our choice. Further, no faculty is bestowed without a purpose. Now man has the faculty of judging and counseling about all matters relative to his own actions, whether in the use of externals, or in giving a loose or a tight rein to our internal passions. But this would be of no use, if our choice were the result of the heavenly bodies and not in our own power. Therefore the heavenly bodies are not the cause of our choice. Besides, man is naturally a civil or social animal. This is evident from the fact that one man does not suffice for himself if he live alone, because the things are few wherein nature makes adequate provision for man, since she gave him his reason by means of which he might provide himself with all necessaries of life, such as food, clothes and so forth, for the production of which one man is not enough. Wherefore man has a natural inclination for social life. Now, the order of providence does not deprive a thing of what is natural to it; rather is each thing provided for according to its nature, as we have said above. Therefore man is not so made by the order of providence that he be deprived of social life. Yet he would be deprived of it, were our choice to proceed from the influence of heavenly bodies, like the natural instinct of other animals. Moreover, laws and precepts of conduct would be useless, were man not the master of his own choice, and useless too would be punishments and rewards for good and wicked, if it were not in our power to choose this or that. And yet, if there were not such things, there would be at once an end to social life. Consequently, man is not so made according to the order of providence that his choice should result from the movements of heavenly bodies. Again, a man's choice is of good and evil things. Hence, if our choosing is the result of the movements of the stars, it would follow that the stars are the per se cause of wicked deeds. But that which is evil has no natural cause, since evil is incidental to a defective cause, and has no per se cause, as we have proved. Therefore it is impossible that our choice be the direct and per se effect of the heavenly bodies. Someone, however, might endeavor to meet this argument by saying that every evil choice results from the desire of some particular good, as we have proved above. Thus the choice of the lustful man arises from his desire for a good consisting in sexual pleasure, and some star causes movement to this good in general. In fact, this is necessary for the generating of animals, and this common good was not to be omitted on account of the particular evil of an individual, who through this instigation chooses an evil. But this reply is not sufficient if we suppose the heavenly bodies to be the per se cause of our choice, through making direct impressions on our intellect and will, because the impression made by a universal cause is received in a thing according to that thing's mode. Consequently, the effect of a star which causes a movement towards pleasure connected in an ordinate manner with generation, will be received into a thing according to the mode proper thereto. Thus we see that various animals have various ways and various times of coming together, as becomes their nature, as Aristotle remarks. Hence the intellect and will receive the impression of that star according to their mode. Now when a thing is desired according to the mode of the intellect and reason, there is no sin in the choice, which is always evil through not being according to right reason. Therefore if the heavenly bodies were the cause of our choice, we should never make an evil choice. Further, no active power extends to things above the species and nature of the agent, because every agent acts through its form. Now, to will, As also to understand, transcends every corporeal species, for just as our intellect understands the universal, so also is our will refer to the universal. For instance, sweet is like every kind of thief, as the philosopher says. Therefore the act of the will is not caused by a heavenly body. Besides, things directed to an end are proportionate to that end. Now, our choice is directed to happiness as our last end. And this does not consist in bodily goods, but in the union of our soul, through the intellect, with divine things. This was proved above to be an article of faith and in accordance with the opinion of philosophers. Therefore heavenly bodies cannot be the cause of our choice. Wherefore it is said, be not afraid of the signs of heaven which the heathens fear, for the laws of people are vain. We hereby refute the opinion of the Stoics, who held that all our actions, even our every choice, are governed by the heavenly bodies. This is also said to have been the opinion of the Pharisees among the Jews of old. The Priscillianists were also guilty of this error, as stated in De Hieresibus. This was also the opinion of the ancient physicists, who held that intellect differs not from sense. Wherefore Empedocles, as quoted by Aristotle, said that the will of man, like that of other animals, is strengthened presently i.e., according to the present moment, by the movement of the heaven which is the cause of time. We must observe, however, that although heavenly bodies are not the direct cause of our choosing, by making a direct impression on our will, nevertheless indirectly they do occasion our choice, through making an impression on bodies. This happens in two ways. First, the impression made by a heavenly body on bodies other than our own may be an occasion of our making a particular choice. Thus, when through the action of the heavenly bodies the air becomes intensely cold, we choose to warm ourselves by the fire, or to do something similarly befitting the time being. Secondly, they may make impressions on our own body, and when the body is affected, movements of the passions arise, either because such impressions make us liable to certain passions, for instance the bilious are prone to anger, or because they produce in us a bodily disposition that occasions a particular choice. Thus when we are ill, we choose to take medicine. Sometimes too, the heavenly bodies are a cause of human acts, when through an indisposition of the body a person goes out of his mind, and loses the use of reason. Such persons are not capable of choosing properly speaking, but they are moved by a natural instinct, like dumb animals. It is evident, however, and we know by experience, that such occasions, whether exterior or interior, are not a necessary cause of choice, since man can use his reason to reject or obey them. But those who follow their natural bent are in the majority, and few, the wise alone to wit, are those who avoid the occasions of ill-doing and who follow not the impulse of nature. Hence Ptolemy says, Centiloque 8, 7, 1, that the soul of the wise man assists the work of the stars, and that the astrologer cannot read the stars unless he knows well the bent of the mind and the natural temperament, and that the astrologer should not express himself in detail but only in general terms, because the majority resist not their bodily disposition, and so the impression of the stars takes effect in them, but not always in this or that individual who, maybe, uses his reason to resist that inclination. Chapter 86. That corporeal effects in this lower world do not result of necessity from the action of the heavenly bodies. Not only are the heavenly bodies unable to necessitate man's choice, but even corporeal effects do not proceed from them of necessity. For the impressions of universal causes are received by their effects according to the mode of the recipient. Now the things of this lower world are fluctuating and changeable, both by reason of matter which is in potentiality to several forms, and on account of the contrariety of forms and powers. Therefore the impressions of heavenly bodies are not received of necessity by these lower bodies. Again, a remote cause does not lead to a necessary result, unless the middle cause be also necessary in a syllogism. For instance, if the major premise be a necessary statement, and the minor a contingent statement, the conclusion that follows is not necessary. Now heavenly bodies are remote causes, and the proximate causes of the effects here below are the active and passive forces in the bodies of this lower world, and these are not necessary, but contingent, causes, for they may fail in a few instances. Therefore the heavenly bodies do not produce necessary effects in these lower bodies. Besides, the heavenly bodies are always moved in the same way. Consequently, if heavenly bodies produced an effect on these lower bodies of necessity, there would be no variety in the things that happen to them. Now, they are not always the same, but only for the most part. Therefore they do not happen necessarily. Moreover, many contingencies do not make one necessary thing, since, just as each one of them by itself may fail in its effect, so too may all of them together. Now, it is evident that in these lower bodies each thing that happens through the influence of the heavenly bodies is a contingency. Therefore the things that happen here below through the influence of heavenly bodies are not necessarily connected, since it is evident that each one of them may be hindered. Further, the action of the heavenly bodies is in keeping with their nature, so that they require matter on which to act. Consequently, their action does not remove what is required by matter. Now the matter on which heavenly bodies act is the bodies of the lower world, and since these are by nature corruptible, they can fail in action just as they can fail in being, so that their nature requires that they should not produce their effects of necessity. Therefore the effects of heavenly bodies on the bodies of the lower world do not result of necessity. Perhaps someone will say that the effects of heavenly bodies must necessarily follow, and yet potentiality is not therefore moved from this lower world, because each effect is in potentiality before it comes into being, and is then set to be possible. But when it is in act, it passes from potentiality to necessity, the whole of which process is subject to the heavenly movements, and consequently a given effect is not prevented from having been possible at one time, although it is necessary that it result at some time. In fact, Albumisar strives thus to plead the cause of possibility in the first book of his Introductorium. But the case for possibility cannot be defended in this way, for there is one kind of possible which follows from that which is necessary, because that which must be necessarily, is possible, since what cannot possibly be, is impossible, and that which is impossible, necessarily is not. Consequently what must necessarily be, must necessarily not be which is impossible. Hence it is impossible that the same thing should be necessarily, and yet that at the same time it should be impossible for it to be. Therefore possible being follows from necessary being. But it is not this kind of possible that we need defend in contradiction to the statement that effects result of necessity, but the possible which is contrary to necessary, in which sense we say that a thing may possibly be or not be. Now a thing is said to be possible or contingent not merely because it is at one time potential and at another time actual, as the foregoing reply supposes, since thus, even in the heavenly movements there is possibility and contingency. For the sun and moon are not always actually in conjunction or opposition, but sometimes actually and sometimes potentially, and yet these are necessary things, since such matters are subject to demonstration. But the possible or contingent that is contrary to the necessary, is of such a nature that there is no necessity for it to be, when it is not. And the reason for this is that it does not result necessarily from its cause. Thus we say that it is a contingency that Socrates will sit, whereas it is a necessity that he will die, because the latter results from its cause necessarily, and not the former. Consequently if it follows necessarily from the movements of the heavenly bodies that their effects will result at some time, there will be nothing possible or contingent contrary to that which is necessary. We must observe, however, that Avicenna, having a mind to prove that the effects of heavenly bodies result of necessity, offers the following argument. Metaphysics 10. If an effect of the heavenly bodies be hindered, this must be due to some cause either voluntary or natural. Now every cause, whether voluntary or natural, is reducible to some heavenly principle. Therefore even the impediment to the heavenly body's effect results from some heavenly principles. Consequently, if we take the whole heavenly order at once, it is impossible for its effect ever to fail. Whence he concludes that the heavenly bodies must necessarily produce effects in the lower things, both voluntary and natural. This argument, as Aristotle observes, was employed by some of the ancients, who denied the existence of chance and luck, for the reason that every effect has its definite cause, and that given the cause the effect follows of necessity, so that, since everything happens necessarily, nothing can be referred to luck or chance. He solves this argument by denying the two propositions on which it is based. One is that given any cause whatsoever, the effect must follow of necessity. For this is not true of every cause, since even the per se, proper and sufficient cause of a certain effect may be hindered through the clashing of another cause, so that it fails to produce that effect. The other proposition which he denies is that not everything that exists in any way whatever has a per se cause, but only that which exists per se, and things which exist accidentally, have no cause at all. For instance, that a man be musical is to be ascribed to a cause, but that he be musical as well as white, is not due to any cause, because whatever things concur on account of a cause, are mutually dependent by reason of that cause, whereas accidental things are not mutually dependent. Consequently, they are not the result of a per se active cause, but are merely an accidental result. Thus it is accidental to the teacher of music that his pupil be a white man, since it is beside his intention, for his intention is to teach one who has an aptitude for music. Accordingly, given any particular effect, we shall say that it had a cause from which it did not necessarily result, because it might have been hindered by the accidental concurrence of another cause. And although we may trace that concurrent cause to some higher cause, we cannot ascribe to any cause the concurrence itself that proved to be a hindrance. Consequently, we cannot say that the hindrance to this or that effect is to be traced to some heavenly principle. Therefore, we must not allow that the effects of heavenly bodies happen of necessity in this lower world. Hence Damascene says in the second book, that heavenly bodies do not cause the generation of things that are made, nor the corruption of things that are destroyed, because, to wit, their effects do not follow of necessity. Aristotle too says that many things betokened by corporeal things, even heavenly bodies, by water for instance or wind, do not happen. For if a stronger movement arise than that which presaged the future, the latter fails in its effect. Even so, we often renounce our first intent on account of other and better thoughts. Ptolemy also says again, we must not think that the things which occur through the influence of higher beings are inevitable, like those which happen by divine decree and are altogether unavoidable, and such as do actually and necessarily occur. He says again in the Centiloquium, these principles which I have given you are midway between the necessary and the possible. Dash.